name is Andy, A-N-D-I-E. I know there are multiple ways to spell it.
Incredible.
My pronouns are they, them. I identify as a non-binary lesbian. And I am a working poet slash a TA in the English department at the University of Irvine.
Okay. So, I've been telling everybody the thing that made me want to talk to them. And the thing that made me want to talk to you is obviously your poetry. I adore it. And you write so beautifully about girlhood.
Thank you, Nat.
And I would love to hear, like, why is girlhood such a spot for you, especially in conjunction with your queerness?
I was talking to my mom about this last week, and I think my party line, like the line that I go to when I'm asked that question, is like, I think being a girl is the most interesting thing that's ever happened to me. I think that my image of girlhood has always been intertwined with this idea of, like, decadence and intricacy. And, like, when you think about the aesthetics of girlhood, like, they are so layered. And it's just something that I'm very, very interested in unpacking, but also something that, like, I feel very, very special and very, very lucky to have gotten to be a girl. A lot of the sadness and a lot of the hurt that comes in my work and comes through, like, the expression of gender is also, like, very, very rooted in this, like, faith in girlhood that I see as, like, a really good starting point for my expression of myself.
Yeah. I'm going to, as a jumping off point, bring up this thing that we have said to each other often. Which is that we like talking about girlhood with each other because we handle it with white gloves, like little archaeologists. Can you talk about that idea of, like, girlhood as a dead culture?
Yeah,
that's something we talk about a lot.
I was actually going to use the word dead culture. I feel like in the work you and I do in particular, it's the examination of girlhood. I feel like a lot of what I am doing, it's unpacking those intricacies. It's taking apart its layers and examining them, which in a lot of ways, like, does feel like dissecting a corpse. And, like, when I talked about, like, the sadness that comes with gender and the sadness that comes with, like, being on a gender journey, like, I think a lot of it is grief. Like, it is a special, sacred thing to be a girl. I'm not a girl anymore in a lot of ways. I always will be in others because I always will be a part of that community and I always will have those experiences. But there's a lot of grief and, like, the feeling of writing about girlhood and the feeling of just dissecting those feelings through art often feels like talking about something that was once, that looked like a dead lover, you know, like something that, like, once was very, very intimate to me and, like, the letting go of it was just as intimate, you know?
I wonder if you could talk about, like, what you mean when you talk about it as, like, an intimate experience. Like, what about girlhood is special? What about it is special? Can you put it into words if you can?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah, I think I can. I might lead my way into it with some thinking. What about girlhood is special? I mean, like, I think it, like, I'm a Jewish person, and a lot of my, like, beliefs about life and my beliefs about value are rooted in the idea that, like, existence is a miracle, and, like, the acceptance of existence as a miracle, wherever you take that gift from, like, it is a gift. It is a gift that, like, you are not even asked to take, you are given. And, like, I feel like for me, like, girlhood is a very, very similar type of gift. Like, it is something that I was given and had to learn to accept, and had to, like, learn how to accept gracefully. And I think, like, you know, a lot of these things can be said about all sorts of expressions of gender and all sorts of expressions of personhood, which is why it feels difficult to answer the question about, like, what about girlhood is special. And I think, like, my real answer, Nat, is, like, I'm special and you're special and, like, we are special within the context of girlhood. And, like, I'm interested in talking about that, you know?
Yeah. I think something that I also love is you think a lot about girls when they're not under surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what are girls doing when it's just
mm-hmm.
girls?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd love to hear, like, any stories you have about experiences like that, or even just, like, your thoughts about the idea of unsupervised, unsurveilled girls.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. My immediate thought, when we talk about this, is about sexuality.
Mm-hmm. That's why I brought it up.
And about kind of, like, early experiences of desire. And how grotesque desire can feel within a girlish body. And that's something I still wrestle with a lot. I feel like a lot of my conversations, in particular with you, are often about the images of femininity and, like, want, and how that want is often ugly. Like, we talk a lot about rage and jealousy. I think the two of us do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, like, those images are inseparable from images of desire because they are intimate and because they are private and because they are something that you were told as a girl other people cannot see you doing. And then there becomes something intimate about that, you know, mm-hmm. it's something you do with yourself. And I'm interested in, like, the things girls do to take care of themselves and each other in secret. And, like, by that, I do mean masturbation, but I also mean, like, you know, the way we look out for other girls on the internet, in particular. I mean, like, the way we cry over our friends, all sorts, everything that girls instinctually know they have to do behind closed doors.
I love to listen to you talk.
Thanks.
It's a joy. Every time. Yeah, we've been very big.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about you.
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
Okay.
like, I am really interested in your experience, maybe not with these words, but with masculinity and femininity mm-hmm. as a child, and then growing through girlhood and how that relationship has changed and, I mean, continues to change.
Yeah. I mean, like, okay. I grew up in a hyper-traditional, white, privileged household, and I think my first experiences with femininity were relentlessly positive because I was a child, and I was told because I was a girl child, I was always going to be taken care of in some way. Like, you know, I think as a girl, your job to a certain extent is to be preserved. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. You gave me that image of, like, those little patent black shoes you have as a little girl
yeah.
with the little bows. And it's like, your job as a girl is to be ready to put on those shoes at any moment, is to be preserved and to be displayed. And, like, there's a lot of safety in that as a child, because that's what you're supposed to do as a child. You know, not necessarily to be displayed, but you're supposed to keep yourself safe, and you're supposed to be able to count on the people around you to keep yourself safe. And, like, that was my experience growing up. And then I think at around 12, 13, that box started to feel really, really small in a way that I really, like, heavily identified with, like, second wave feminism at the time. Like, this idea that, like, the way gender had been presented to me limited me and, like, infantilized me in a way. And I was just so full of rage. And I didn't understand at the time that that was something that a lot of teenage girls go through. And that it was equally beautiful. And I started being very, very angry. And if you're angry enough, I think that if you do anything for long enough, you start doing it gracefully. And I think that I got very gracefully angry. I started writing a lot. I started presenting very differently. Still very, like, feminine, but a little punkier. And then, you know, and I was an angry teenager, and I felt like I had something to prove, and I felt like I could prove that from being a different type of girl, and, like, I feel like I felt like I was kind of inventing that type of girl as I went, and then I realized, obviously, that that was a very naive place to come from, which is such a comforting feeling to realize that you have a history of people who have invented the thing that you thought you invented, and, like, every single one of them has been on that journey and like it has led them beautiful places. Mm-hmm. And I really started to identify kind of with this like punkier identity of like womanhood and this like poetic identity of womanhood as like a place to get in touch with your feelings from, or a place to get in touch with nature from, or like a perspective on the universe that gave you a particular access to like the scope of human emotion. All of these things are things I felt at 15 and 16 that felt very, very real. And then I continued to grow up, and I would say like my journey with femininity had hit like a rage spike at like 15 and 16. And it was beautiful, and I would never regret that. But ever since then, I've kind of mellowed out. I think, like, as I've come to be more comfortable with my identity as a lesbian, I felt a lot more peace, and I felt a lot less desire to prove things to people, because love feels more real, because it feels more right, and, like, you know, I've mellowed out, and, like, the journey I am on now with my femininity and my gender is not towards proving anything to anyone, and it's not towards escaping any boxes. It's towards finding peace and comfort with myself and accepting that the places that the peace and comfort come from might change. So that's a very long-winded answer to your question.
I love a long-winded answer. I would love nothing more than the longest winded answers you can provide me. Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to talk about your lesbian journey.
Yeah.
Because it's so intertwined with girlhood.
It is. It is. Like, do you just want, like, the facts of it all? The cold, hard truths of it all?
Sure.
Okay. I, like, I went into high school and I was angry. I didn't know why. Mm-hmm. But I was really angry. and I went to a Catholic high school, and I played water polo, and I felt uncomfortable in my skin. And then one of the girls in my friend group came out as a lesbian, and I was like, well, that's very, very interesting, but that is a part of myself that I simply can't examine.
As usual, you were busy.
I was busy. I was on academic decathlon.
So yes, there was this person on my academic decathlon team who at the time was identifying as a woman, and I was just like obsessed with them. I was obsessed with everything about them. I wanted to be around them all the time. I hated their long-term, long-distance boyfriend, as one often does. Yeah, I just, like, I had, like, a very authentic, like, little teenage crush on them. So, yeah, I was obsessed with this person. They were all I wanted to think about. And then I went off to college, and I wanted to think about other people.
And I realized that I didn't want to think about boys ever. And that when I did, it was usually, I was usually always thinking about my parents, actually. Like, whenever I went on dates with boys, I was thinking about whether or not he would get along with my dad. And, like, what it would look like to, like, bring him home to my parents. And that felt really, really good and really, really affirming. Because I love my parents and I wanted their pride really, really bad. I still do. And so, yeah, I was like, well, I don't know if I'm a lesbian. I think I could still be attracted to a man. But I only want to be with girls. And that was my answer. That was my answer for a minute there. And then I dated someone pretty long term. I had my first like long term girlfriend, which you were there for the thick and the thin of. And like, I think the reason that relationship expanded in my mind, is because for the first time I thought like I could be with someone who loved me forever. And like that was like so hopeful and so real and so beautiful. I was also 19. And so I didn't really have a scope of forever. And I think we were both very, very young and very, very dumb. And like when that relationship fell apart, I was left with myself.
In a canoe.
I was left with myself in a canoe. Famously, my best friend in the world, who, like, if you want to talk about, like, asexuality and like, platonic intimacy, I consider Kate my long-term partner. But, yeah, no, I was left with Kate, but also with myself. And Kate being the intuitive and sensitive person, knew that that was a really important time to me, for me to be, like, on my own. And, like, I came out the other side with myself and, like, with a self that I had created through all of these experiences. And, like, I think ever since then I've just kind of known, like, people can come into my life and I can love them, and, like, I am going to leave the other side me. And, like, me as a lesbian. And, like, my gender expression is very, very fluid. It's, like, you've heard the narrative. It has a lot to do with where I'm at intellectually, like, where I'm at as far as what I want to give to other people and how that comes out. But, like, the love is always for lesbians. And, like, that part of my heart is always for queer people. Mm-hmm. and I was left with that, and I've just kind of been carrying that around in my pocket ever since.
Every word you say, I feel so thrilled. yeah. All right, well, lesbians.
Lesbians.
We love them.
We love them.
Can we talk about why we love them?
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about what's special about being a girl.
Yeah.
What's special about being a dyke?
What's special about being a dyke? Can I answer your question in a way that's going to seem irrelevant?
However you want.
Okay.
This is your interview.
I'm going to do a wraparound. So I've started working on this series of poems that are all kind of love letters, musings, portraits of the boy that I thought I'd be dating at 22 when I was 12. And, like, the reason I'm writing those poems is because I'm insanely lucky, and, like, I am living my dream life. Like, we're sitting in my gorgeous apartment right now, that I have because I make money writing poetry, which is nutso. But the thing that's crucially different is I don't even have a single boyfriend. So I've been writing these poems that are these kinds of musings to this boy, and at first it was a really, really fun project. Because this boy is kind of an amorphous figure who can take on all sorts of different personalities and bodies and projections. He's really just like a cloud I project things onto, and it gives me a lot of space. But in that space, I've been filling in a lot of what my desire for love looked like at 12. And, like, I've been examining that closely, and I think what I've found is, like, the end goal of this project is to, like, write love letters to, like, the lesbians, particularly mask lesbians, who, like, have romanced me in a way that's kind of taken me off my feet, which sounds like a little cheesy to say out loud, but, like, I think that there's something, like, I've always wanted to be loved in a way that is nurturing and that is building, and that in a way that feels safe. And, like, when I think about being a dyke, and when I think about the love that I have for, like, you, Nat, and, like, the friendship that we share that is so sacred to me, like, I think about safety, and I think about the safety that comes with intimacy, the safety that comes with to opening those doors that you've told, these are things you always have to do in private, these are the parts of yourself you have to hide in order to be a person, the safety that comes with opening that door, and, like, having people love you and support you and reflect the things you feel and your rage and your jealousy and your lust back to you is so incredibly intimate. And I love dykes for it. And, like, I want to be a part of the community that creates space for everyone to come in and to feel that intimacy and to feel like that is just as human as the parts of them that they are allowed to show to a more normative public.
I love dykes.
I love dykes. Shout out to dykes.
Shout out to dykes. They're doing it in a way nobody else is doing it. Oh, well, Andy, you're a poet. I'd love to talk about words with you.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would like to talk about the word dyke.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the word lesbian.
Yeah.
Because you talked about how it's hard to be a lesbian when you're 14.
It is hard to be a lesbian when you're 14. It's hard to be a lesbian when you're 22.
And it's a hard word to accept. I know both of us went through our little, I'm bisexual because that's less scary.
Right.
Moment. Yeah. And that's not because bisexuality is less valid.
No.
We were just hiding in it because it was less scary.
I was praying for a chance that I could bring a boy home to my family. You know? Like I still think that'd be so cool. And that's why I collect men. No, I have a lot of male friends who I love.
I know this.
I call my boyfriends because I've got reasons.
They're
my boys. But yes, the word dyke and the word lesbian within a poetic context.
Just in general.
Whatever
you want to talk about.
I was thinking about this last night a little bit. I've never written a poem with the word dyke or the word lesbian in it.
That's crazy.
Which is nuts. Yeah. And I don't really know why. Like, I do. I know why. But also, like, those feelings of fear and those feelings of disgust are something that I've confronted so intentionally and so daily in, like, my life outside of my work. But, like, even in the world of poetry, which is so based in art and is so based in expression, I think that I still have this, like, thin film shield around my sexuality that I'm trying to deconstruct. But, like, you know, like, it's a long process, and, like, I think that, like, thinking about girlhood with you and thinking about how being a girl, in my experience and in your experience, is kind of inseparable from being a dyke has made me think about, like, why that narrative doesn't exist in my work yet and what the space is for it. So, yeah, I think that I was around a lot of lesbians in undergrad. And it was such a crucial daily part of my identity. And it still is. I'm still a lesbian every single day. But I think that as my environment has changed and as I've moved into doing things more professionally with my career, and, like, just so happens that not everyone around me is a dyke anymore.
Boo.
I know, right? It's this confrontation of, like, my own isms about being a lesbian has come slower and has come less intentionally, in a way which this is a great reminder that it's daily work, and that is work that isn't done if it's not difficult and if I'm not confronting the things that are hard about it. Yeah, and, like, I love my cohort, I love my peers, I love the poets I'm around, but, like, my experiences of being a lesbian are unique because I'm plus size, and they're unique because I have an interesting relationship with sexuality and an interesting relationship with monogamy and an interesting relationship with abuse and all these things. And, like, you know, those are still things that I have thin film walls of shame around that, you know, it's daily work to deconstruct. And, like, I think that the word dyke and, like, saying that word out loud for me is, like, an intentional part of, like, poking at that film and, like, reminding myself that there is a history of shame, and there is also a history of people like me taking ownership of that shame and, you know, and transforming through that.
I know. We always talk about weird little girls.
Yeah.
We always are thinking about weird little girls.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling about weird little girls right now?
I feel like recently I've been... Yesterday I wore all black head to toe, like a very long skirt and a turtleneck, and then I did my hair all funky, which is something I really wanted to do at 14 when I started Catholic high school. I thought that was the epitome of fashion. And so right now I've been thinking about, like, the awkward space between, like, the safety of, like, little girlhood and, like, the assurance of, like, big girlhood and, like, kind of the feeling of outgrowing. Like I'm talking, like, 12 to 13, 14, 15, even girlhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of the reason that I've been thinking about that is because, like, I'm starting to feel like the role model I needed at that age, which is a interesting way to reconnect back to my girlhood that, like, could not have happened if I didn't kill off my experiences of being a girl. You know, and, like, I just, like, I think when you get to the other side of something and when you get to the other side of something that you very intentionally broke, like, you get this really incredible opportunity to look back on it with, like, a lot of love and a lot of tenderness. And, like, for me, like, punk culture in particular is, like, inseparable from love, and, like, inseparable from, like, radical tenderness towards others. and like I just want to give every 12 to through 15 year old girl out there who feels like she is outgrowing her body at a rapid speed just like the biggest hug. And like, yeah, I when I said earlier that I'm seeking peace, I think what I mean is I want to feel like all my actions are movements towards giving that hug. You know?
Yeah, I do. Oh, I love that you said you had to break girlhood.
Yeah.
You had to break her.
I gotta break her.
What? How did you break her? What'd you do to her?
How did I break girlhood? Let me think. I think that the first step is understanding that the space society has created for girls. I'm looking at the text Blue sent me about Caroline Rose. Speaking of girls. I think the first step of, like, breaking girlhood is understanding that, like, the quote-unquote safety and the quote-unquote security and preservedness that comes with being a girl in society is falsified. And that understanding that, like, this position of sacredness is like, dehumanizing, and, like, very intentionally so. It's this kind of, like, very, very soft way to tell someone that they are best sequestered. And, like, yeah, I think that the first step for me of breaking girlhood was realizing that it was too small and that it was built too small. I wasn't too big, it was too small. And that's just my experience. But I feel like it's very, very true to this, like, societal image of being a little girl. And then I think then there's the breaking, you know? Then there's the pounding down of those walls and the breaking of it. As, like, a box where you have to sit, and then you're out of that box. And I think that there's, like, where I'm at right now is, like, there's some real joy in, like, being out of that box, doing the really hard work of breaking it, and then coming out the other side and being like, well, I am still, like, a beautiful feminine person. And, like, all the things I loved about myself as a girl are still true. They're just, like, free. I can just go wherever I want with that energy. And, like, yeah, so I feel like the process of breaking down girlhood is, like, you know, you rip through it, and then you come out the other side and it's not holding you back anymore. It's just there.
It's just there. Jesus. I want to go back to what you said earlier about, lesbian desire is a secret.
Yeah.
When we're little girls.
Yeah.
Because I remember that. Mm-hmm. I know you remember it.
Oh, yeah.
I would love some stories.
God. I was talking about this with, one of my really, really good friends the other night. I was talking about I've been talking a lot about Lindsay Lohan recently. To you, to everybody. Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears are big hot points when I think about young lesbianism for me. Because I think there's this, like, forbiddenness to, like, girls who were bad in ways that my parents weren't willing to tell me about, that just, like, always reeked of sex for me. Mm-hmm. Because sex was always forbidden. And so, you know, those women, Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears, like, were hurt. They were hurt by the boxes of sexuality and the boxes of forbiddenness, that were put around them, like, deeply, deeply damaged, and I would never try to, like, speak to those experiences for them, or speak to, like, what that did for society. But, like, for me, being a bad girl was hot. And I looked at girls who were doing things wrong and facing consequences with a very intimate eye from, like, a very, very young age in a way that I think shaped my sexuality. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, I think that led me into a lot of perilous situations. I think that, like, people don't often talk about how dangerous it is to be a young queer person, because if you're doing everything in secret, you're not getting proper support, and, like, some of those things that you're keeping a secret
you're keeping a secret because you know they're dangerous. And, like, in a young mind, it's sometimes hard to tell the difference between something you're keeping a secret because you're ashamed and something you're keeping a secret because it's dangerous for you. But, like, it goes back to freedom as well. Like, the freedom to keep a secret. But, like, yeah, I think as I've gotten older and my sexuality has developed, I think it's also, like, the freedom to tell a secret, mm-hmm. which goes back to, like, dyke love and, like, dyke community. Like, it's the freedom to tell a secret. It's the freedom to, like, share intimacy with people and trust them with it, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's like being in one big room of secrets when you're hanging out with dykes.
It's so many
except
secrets.
For you all know them.
Yeah, it's not, they're not secrets anymore. They become something else. It's like the idea of, like, girlhood becoming something else in a lot
yeah.
of ways, you know?
Yeah.
The project is in a really interesting place. I guess I'll give some background.
I was gonna say, tell the people who Cool Girl is.
Okay. How graphic can I get?
As graphic as you would damn please.
Okay. So this summer, I was having a really interesting coming to know moment with my sexuality, where I started talking to someone who was very formative for my sexuality, who's recently come out as a trans woman, and kind of tangentially to that, like, it had nothing to do with it, it just so happened, fate, I believe in magic, we reconnected right when she started coming out as a trans woman,
mm-hmm.
And I was also in this position where I was taking ownership over my sexuality, and I was like, that's very cool, by the way, I would like to have sex with you, which is something that I don't usually say to people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I don't, it's a type of my desire that I don't usually take ownership of, but it's a type of desire I know I have. And I started, when I was up there having sex with her and her wife, I was thinking a lot about who I became when I take ownership of that desire. And, like, when that part of me comes to the surface, who am I? And I thought a lot about straight women. And I thought a lot about the really hot straight women I know who feel no shame about their desire and who are so at peace with it and how I want to be just like them, but me. And Cool Girl is kind of this hyper-feminine, hyper-traditional, but also, like, radical in that fact version of womanhood for me. That is, like, every desire on the surface, every desire you can think of, and, like, truly, like, every desire you can think of a woman having, and that's what I mean by typical. And so I started writing these poems from the perspective of and to the voice of Cool Girl. And, like, they're weird, they're funky, they're strange, they come out as kind of almost, like, enchantments. Or, like, spells. I have one called Cool Girl Come Blood, where it's when I read aloud, I ask the audience to, every time I say Cool Girl, they say Come Blood, and, like, in that, it kind of has this, like, invoking power, like, it feels like we're summoning something, and it's really fun, and I love this Cool Girl project. I love Cool Girl, Cool Girl opened this door for me into this kind of work I'm doing right now about the origins of womanhood and what it means to summon femininity and, like, where we summon it from, that has led me down a very biblical path. So the way that the Cool Girl Project has kind of taken into now is I'm thinking about girlhood and I'm thinking about womanhood in many, many forms, and I'm trying to build these forms from the ground up. So I have this Cool Girl work, and I have these portraits of these boys that don't exist and that are, like, very clearly ghosts, and then I have very, very personal dialogues with my stories with girlhood that kind of exist in this Venn diagram of three, and they kind of all sometimes blend together, and then kind of in a circle around this Venn diagram, I have this work I'm doing, which I'm calling All Girl Genesis, which, like, the party line for the project is, like, it's like the book of Genesis, but every single thing in it, like, living or dead, is a girl. And just kind of seeing how that changes the story. And I'm in a position with this project right now where I'm trying to figure out to what end. And, like, but, like, that's always been my experience of girlhood, is, like, I'm doing things because they feel right, And then eventually I figure out why I'm doing them and why they feel right. So yeah, that's my work around Cool Girl. She was my doorway into this idea of invoking femininity and summoning femininity and the creation of femininity.
Yeah. Love Cool Girl. Let's talk about femininity, baby.
Yeah.
Because we're both very femme.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean?
I don't know, Nat. I think about it every single day. Femininity is magic because it's behind a thin invisible shield that I can't name. And it's in my life every single day. And like femininity is my root, the tradition I'm rooted in. Like, I want to be just like my mom, like for better or for worse with all of her flaws. I've always wanted to be just like my mom. I've been thinking a lot about the perfume Beautiful by Estee Lauder and how that smells like my mom and like sense memories of femininity and how particular those are. And like that is not a universal feeling, but for me, like that is womanhood and that is femininity. And like there's magic in the fact that everybody understands that. There's magic in the fact that that is like particular to my childhood, but it's something that is understood by the people around me. And it's, like, it's the magic I choose to embrace. Mm-hmm. It's the magic that makes me feel good. I'm particularly interested in, like, punk femininity and edge femininity, like, bottle blonde kind of stuff. And this kind of, like, there's this idea of femininity as natural, as the eve of it all. That I accept, but then I also like this idea that femininity is something that is forced and something that is, you know, uncomfortable in the fact that, like, women are forcing it to exist even if it makes men uncomfortable. And I'm using the terms women and men loosely, and because they are the terms that I have access to right now, I think that there's probably a better way to say that. But yeah, I think femininity is magic. I think it comes from everywhere, and like I think part of its magic is like it's something that comes out in every single thing I do, and I make every single one of my choices actively. But femininity, I think, sits subliminally under the surface. And then like sometimes I make those choices on purpose because I love being a girl, and I love magic, and I love that being a girl happens to me magically.
What's it like to be a girl and not have a gender?
It's so weird. It's like. It's very colorful, I would say. Yeah. Like, I think of gender mostly as we were talking about, that breaking of girlhood. I think of my experience of girlhood as a gender existed in, like, that pre-break era.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the experience of breaking gender left this kind of free, loose girlhood behind. That's, like, very, very floaty and very, very free. And, like, when words exist without like the weight of societal definitions, they become tools of expression.
Mm-hmm.
And I see my girlhood like mostly as a tool of expression. And I understand that's not what girlhood is for everybody.
That wasn't the question.
No, yeah. Yeah. But like for me it is one of the tools I have to show who I am. And like who I am is like someone who was once a little girl. Mm-hmm. And who like really fucking dug that. And, like, really dug playing with femininity from this naive point of, like, with, like, no understanding of its dangers. And, like, everything I have because I started there. Mm-hmm. And, like, now I get to invoke that, I get to summon that version of femininity to express myself.
Ooh. That was beautiful. Let's talk about violence.
Yeah! I love violence.
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the violence of girlhood.
Yeah!
I'm thinking about it because my tummy hurts right now.
Yeah, I was a very angry little girl. And I'm a very angry adult. Which is something I feel a lot of shame around. Because, yeah, anger is often... Like, I've also been, like, victimized by my anger and by the anger of others.
Mm-hmm.
And like made to feel unsafe by anger, and I think that anger can be really, really bad. But I also like I would like to rephrase. I think that anger can be used really, really badly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that anger is not a bad tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, like, trying to teach myself that, like, my anger is not the problem.
Nope.
The problem is when anger and violence are used to make other people unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, or, like, as someone who, like, has felt victimized by anger and violence, like, when those things show up in me, they do not mean that I'm victimizing myself or others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they are tools. Like, I'm starting to think about anger and violence, and this is not something that I'm all the way around yet, but it's where I'm, this is where I'm starting from. I'm starting to think of anger and violence as tools of expression, similar to how I think of girlhood as a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And more so because I'm a writer, like, tools of communication.
Yeah.
Like, I think one of the most powerful things that someone can be as angry, because it invokes a lot of other things, because you are angry for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the anger requires this big storming that eventually softens out into reason. And like, I love to do a big storm and then a softening, and so I'm starting to see anger as a tool. Could I read you something that's been published of mine? Okay, let me pull it up. I'll tell the story while I do it. So, my mother,
what a wonderful start to any story.
My mother was a little girl once, mm-hmm. and she had a different girlhood than I did, and the circumstances of it were just as interesting to me, if not more so than my own. And when my mom was a little girl, she grew up Mormon, and her parents got divorced, and her mom left their community for a lot of different reasons and moved them to California. And my mom was, like, really alone a lot of the time at, like, 12 to 13 in Southern California, kind of when Richard Ramirez was at his height. And, like, this is a story in this poem that I know from my mother, the story of Richard Ramirez coming up to her back door, and trying to get into her house, and her saying and posing as a police officer, as he often did, and her kind of at 12 saying, well, I'm gonna go call the police station and make sure they actually sent someone down here, and then him just running down the hill in their backyard. That's a story that I know from my mom, and like, as everything that I know from my mom, I consider it mostly fable. But it's a fable, because it's, in my head it exists only as fable, it's able to take on, like, an allegorical quality that I really love to think about, like, girlhood as fable and allegory. And you don't get to do that with your own girlhood, you get to do that with other people's. So this is a poem I call When I Find Myself Remembering Richard Ramirez. I try to picture his body before the police came. The good people of San Diego turning him to a liquid which evaporated up from the asphalt where they left him, burning on the street, except the dead teeth which so scattered from his living mouth that taking them was barely stealing, as they were brown and porous, and when planted in their gardens they grew to wine grapes and citrus flowers and other sweet things that take well to the harsh wall of heat carried south by the Santa Ana winds. And in the taking they were saving their daughters, who did not know better than to follow the scent of rot when it popped up around the schools, or showed up at night to lick the screen doors of their bedroom and left spit behind in the netting like small diseased crystals. When I think of the man, I try to think of my mother instead, how she must have been at 14 when she ate the beast with her angry neighbors, who all together turned his body to a gray mush, to a cotton ball covered in blood, to a lamb. I try to picture it, the dark red meat of him, raw, the Southern California summer cooking him, the stench of black road and brown rot rising like smoke. So yeah, that poem was originally published in a Revolut magazine, and then I read it on KUCI Radio for a segment about California history. and now I'm reading it here now because I think it's kind of a nice wrap up with everything we've been talking about. Femininity as generational and rage and figures of men and taking ownership of those figures and kind of reusing them in narratives about girlhood. So yeah.
If people want to find you because they're like, oh my god, that poetry was incredible, and I want to keep up with you, where can they keep up with you, Andy?
Okay, so I have a Twitter specifically dedicated to my poetry. If Woo. You only want to hear poetry news, that's Andy_Klarin. That's Andy_Klarin. And then if you are interested in hearing my less literate musings, I have another Twitter where I like to goof off, which is under the title Bratz Doll No Foot. That's BratzDollNoFoot. And if you're curious whether I'm hot or not, I'm on Instagram under Andy Klarin, all one word, AndyKlarin.
Well, and for the people, are you hot?
I think so. I like to think so.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much,
Thank
Andy.
Thank you, Nat. This was really fun.